Today on Straight Talk Africa, how do the policies of your government reflect your interests and concerns? Are all segments of your society being heard and acknowledged by your governing authorities? If so, most studies show that you are among the most fortunate few in Africa and around the world. That's coming up next right here on Straight Talk Africa. Hello, welcome to Straight Talk Africa, live from the Voice of America headquarters here in Washington. I am Shaka Sali.
And hello to all of our viewers and listeners on the continent and elsewhere. I'm Haley Adams-Fitzpatrick. I'll be your social media reporter.
Today, it's a discussion on the relationship between political inclusion and decentralized government systems in Africa.
And coming up later, our audience has weighed in on our topic through emails, Facebook and Twitter comments. We're going to reveal some of them ahead here on Straight Talk Africa.
The purpose of constitutional reforms in many African countries is to provide socio-economic justice for all citizens. In some cases, that means providing quotas for women and minorities and ceding greater powers to lower levels of government. My colleague Paul Ndiho has more.
Civil society organizations, activists in Africa, say the combination of structural reforms and progressive legislation should ensure the voices of the poor are brought into government decision-making. Increasing the number of women political representatives has also become a significant constitutional issue in most African countries. In Rwanda, the constitution provides a quota for women and other groups in government. As a result, Rwanda leads the world with the share of women in national legislature. But politically speaking, even though Rwanda is decidedly pro-female, when it comes to the roles of men and women, Rwanda is clearly a complicated place. In Kenya, the 2010 constitution introduced a constitutional requirement to guarantee women's inclusion in parliament, the judiciary, and other state organs. It also created a decentralized system of government called devolution. At least 15% of the national budget goes to 47 counties. But critics say devolution is failing. Corruption is widespread, and this has affected the delivery of services. Kenya has also been rocked by a series of strikes from medical practitioners, doctors and nurses, lecturers at public universities, and teachers refusing to teach over poor pay. Earlier this year, President Uhuru Kenyatta's government pushed ahead with a plan to hire 100 Cuban doctors, despite opposition from doctors' union that says the money could be used to employ local physicians instead. Some constitutions support local government efforts to give citizens a direct say in prioritizing the services they need from limited funds. For example, decentralization in Uganda. In 1997, the country adopted the Local Government Act, which decentralized its system of governance. Critics say the system is primarily built on patronage. Uganda's longtime leader, Yoweri Kaguta Museveni, also uses this form of government to reward districts or regions favorable to the ruling party. Uganda has poor healthcare systems, and the country has also been hit by a series of strikes by doctors, nurses, and teachers in a pay dispute. Like Kenya, the government has imported Cuban doctors to work in public hospitals. Nigeria has adopted a three-tier system, federal, state, and local government, that allows citizens to elect their respective representatives. Analysts say Nigeria's lack of transparency and accountability from federal, state, and local government officials has led to widespread corruption. Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari has taken steps to fight corruption, but still, it remains rampant under his leadership. decentralized systems of government, if executed well, can bring about the desired development and help local governments to charter their own future. But for now, that success remains to be seen. Paul Ndiho, VOA News, Washington.
Thanks, Paul, for that interesting report. Joining us here in the studio are two distinguished guests. Dr. Lona Were, founder and director of the International Patient Learning Empowerment and Advocacy, and Dr. Gilbert Mwenedata, former Rwandan presidential aspirant. Well, I have to say sincerely, Lona and Gilbert, that I'm profoundly honored and exceedingly humbled to have the opportunity to host the two of you for the first time on Straight Talk Africa.
Thank you.
You're most welcome. And last but not least, Banji Airoge, a political scientist and activist who also previously served in various capacities with Ondo State and the Nigerian federal government. He joins us live from New York. Thank you so much for joining us on Straight Talk Africa for the first time, Banji.
Thank you.
You're most welcome. Later in the program, we'll give our audience a chance to call in with your question or comment. The number to call is 202-619-3111, and the U.S. country code is 1. Let me come to you, Lona, immediately. You come from the Great Republic of Kenya.
Yes, I do.
What is the status of women empowerment in Kenya?
So basically, to begin with, I must say, because we're talking about devolution, devolution was one of the greatest things that happened to Kenya after the independence, because it's one system that strives to bring leadership as well as services and goods closer to the people. Mm-hmm. And they're also able to be stakeholders in decision making. Also, with devolution came a position within the county government, which is the women's representative position. And that sort of propelled women into leadership, because as a women representative, first of all, she's responsible for making sure that the interest of women and children, especially the girl child, is cared for. And she also has a small budget that is supposed to empower the women, you know, so that they're more economically and probably politically independent. Also, the constitution brought up with the two-third rule, which requires a certain number of women to be elected into legislative positions. So I can say that it's really propelled women to the forefront of decision-making within Kenya.
But what extent, frankly, has it actually worked? Because there are some critics who say that the constitution, frankly, mm-hmm. does not seem to have been implemented the way it was supposed to be, so that it could benefit women and other minorities.
You have a great point, and let's be fair to them. The devolution system in Kenya is pretty new. We just entered our second term. It came from the 2010 constitution and was not implemented until 2013 when the new governors were elected. And when they came into the office, a lot of people didn't understand the constitution yet because it was new. Very many people came into the office without understanding their roles, and especially the role of the women's representative is still questioned up until now. Mm-hmm. They still don't understand what really, you know, their role is, because you have all this new positions that have come up, and Kenya being a male-dominant community, most of the things they do have to be approved by the male. So in that aspect, probably the devolution has not worked. But on the ground, you can see improvements in infrastructure. There's more trade. There's more money circulating within the county government on the ground level. So that's great for women traders, who are selling things, because there's more money to trade with.
I see. What about you, Gilbert? I should apologize for having murdered your last name, really, which should have been pretty easy for me, because it is Mwenedata.
Yeah, that's right.
My brother.
Mm-hmm, thanks.
What about Rwanda? Seems, by any indications, frankly, It looks like we are looking at a world champion here in terms of women empowerment.
Yeah, that's right. Me too. Thank you, first of all, for having me in this studio. And as you said, the other name is Ngene Data. But I also want to clarify, my colleague here is a doctor. I am not. So in the introduction, you may have said doctor, but when it comes to me, I'm not a doctor. So on that one, when it comes to Rwanda being a champion for promoting women, and especially when it comes to the political rights, me too, as a Rwandan, I want to say that in many cases, I feel honored whenever anything good is spoken about my country. But on the other hand, I feel like we also sometimes need to really look carefully at what we are doing and see what impact it is making. So as you said, we have a big number of Rwandans in some decision-making positions. But sometimes the impact is not as big as the numbers. So that's why I can say that sometimes when we really want to look at, to be close enough and look at it, we really have a lot to say about it.
Why do you think that the impact doesn't look good? Why?
Let's see, within the parliament, we have 64% of women in parliament. I really like having that big number.
That is the single largest, by the way, globally.
Actually, yeah, that's right. But does it mean that kind of inclusion we are talking about? Maybe, yeah, there are many in parliament, but also when you look to the few who dared to exercise their political rights, also who are women, I can say we don't only have many of them in parliament, but we also have many of them in jail.
By the way, before you go to many of those who are in jail, what about these legislators? Are they elected or are they appointed? And if it is the latter, who actually appoints them?
Actually, as someone who once tried to run for a seat in parliament, actually, in the past, I also have done that. So, and I know exactly what the process and how to get there. If really having supporters was enough to get there, I should have been there by the time I was running. On this one, I'm really trying to be honest. And any Rwandan who is listening to me right now may agree with me that the number of people who are supporting you is not enough to get there. So as you are saying, it's like, first of all, depending on who is supporting you or on like who asked you to, you know, to run for it, so you are likely to get in. But when it comes to voting, citizens know very well, maybe this may not apply only to Rwanda, but to some other African countries, but their votes don't count, that they, you know, they may just come to the ballot. But I have realized that there is an increasing loss when it comes to the trust that people are having for the system, when it comes to expressing their views and to say, this is the candidate we want to represent us. Actually, people know that when it comes to their representatives, they don't really have a lot to say about it. Someone somewhere decide for you who is to represent you, and you only have to comply. A little thing I can add on this, they also like to say that they see them only short before the elections, and then they are gone for good. They will come back again a few days before the election.
You still haven't really answered my question. Are these women in the Rwandan parliament elected by the people, or are they appointed?
Okay. It's like when the way they say it, the name is elections. So, but when you see how it works, so I think like I can say what is said is not necessarily what is being done. So normally it is that kind of indirect voting for when it comes to the positions for women. And for the other women, it is also on the list of political parties. So depending on the number you are given on the list, so then you can get in. Just to give you an example, each political party will give names of both men and women, and number one, number two, number three, and depending on how much they win, like RPF always is winning 40 seats in parliament, so that would mean if you are among the 40 people who are from 1 up to 40, so you are likely to get in parliament. So did people vote for you? Maybe, but you are just on the list of a political party. So you vote for a party, and then they give you whoever they want to give you.
By RPF, I suppose you mean the Rwandese Patriotic Front, the ruling party.
That's right.
That's very good. What about Bungie?
Well, the Nigerian government, like you said, seems to be focusing on corruption. But there is no greater corruption than what is happening now, in the sense that the federal government actually robs all the component parts of the country, that is the state government and the local government, rob them of revenue, or perhaps mop up this revenue and bring it to the center, where some of the states or most of the state can't even pay salaries to their workers. Items like driver's license, like registration of vehicles, even sales tax that should go directly to the states and local government are being mopped up by the federal government, and then a little pittance are thereby distributed to the states in return to manage their affairs. And that is why the people of Nigeria are clamoring for devolution of power, or what you call structural adjustment, or true federal system. Until we have that, where you can have most of the items on the exclusive list of the federal government has to go on the concurrent list, in which case both the local and the state, and in fact the federal government, can actually act on items on those lists, and then we can actually leave in the exclusive list items like the foreign affairs, or items like the post office, or the armed forces can remain in the list of the federal government. That is what Nigerians are clamoring for. If you look at the news this week, it's about the massacre of almost 200 people in the central region of Plateau State. And this happens because the governor of the state has no command structure. He has nothing to say to the police to arrest the situation. There is no state police in that region, only the federal. All the governor can do is to appeal to the president or the inspector general of the police, who is stationed in the federal capital, to help the people. And this has been lacking. And Nigerians have been calling for the government, for the constitutional authorities to create a system that allows the individual states and individual local governments to be able to serve the people, by not tying down their hands in doing their constitutional duties.
Earlier, Dr. Lona Were said that Kenya is a male-dominated system. She could, of course, have also said it is patriarchy. What about Nigeria?
Well, the problem is not that it's not that of women versus men in Nigeria. The question is that we should have a system that works for all, and then in the local centers, then women can participate. I mean, we have no problem. Women have participated in all the in most of the elections. If they feel to, I mean, if they feel they have to, they will. It's not a problem for us, so to say. But we have to work out the constitution to be able to be responsive to the need of the local people first. Then women, I've heard people say we should devote 35% of elective office to the women. I don't think we have any problem with that.
I see.
But how, yeah, we don't, 35% of the positions. In fact, the way I look at it in Nigeria is that women can have the lion's share if they are competent enough to be able to. I mean, and there are a lot of competent Nigerian women that are ready to actually come out. But right now, what are they coming out to do? They are hampered by the law or by the federal might. And the federal government is not allowing the local the localities to be able to carry out the functions that will serve the need of the and they, I mean, if care is not taken, and let me say this for emphasis, if care is not taken, Nigeria may be sitting on a keg of gunpowder because it may lead to war. Look at what is going on in Plateau State, like I said, this week. More than 200 people have been murdered. And the government, the federal government, the president seems to be nonchalant about it. And we are saying that this is an example of devolution of power. If the locals have control of their police, obviously 200 people will not be slaughtered. And this goes beyond allowing women. Women can easily come in their local, in their localities and run for office. We have no problem with that in Nigeria. I mean, there are women in our Senate. There are women in the House of Assemblies. There are women all over in politics. However, we are saying that bring it to the local government, the state government should be the first line of government entities to carry out some of these some of these reforms that we're talking about.
To what extent has the three-tier system succeeded, for example, in taking services to the people? Because there are some critics who say that, on the contrary, what probably it has succeeded in doing is creating some jobs for the elite.
Yeah, exactly. The three-tier system is on paper. What is the point of having a three-tier system when the federal government of Nigeria takes 56% of the revenue accruing to the government? 56%, 32%, 32% are shared by the 36 states, and 10% by 774 states. I mean, by local governments. Now, when you look at that, now we talk of corruption. When you have too much money in your hand in the federal government, that is why you are able to waste. For instance, let me give you an example. Can you imagine that the federal government of Nigeria actually controls the police force throughout the territory? Now, we have 180 million people. The federal government controls, you know, all these. It's so bad that the agency that control traffic is actually managed by the federal government. What then remains for the local government, the state government? Nothing.
I see.
Absolutely.
I see.
What we are having is a situation where a few people sit in the federal government. Once you capture power in the federal government, now you control this destiny of every Nigerian. And people are finding this to be unacceptable. It shouldn't matter to us who becomes president, for instance. if we can go about our normal duties, the education of our children are actually taken care of, and most of the things you need to do are taken care of. Without remaining the external affairs and all that, it shouldn't matter. But in the case of Nigeria, once you capture the federal government, now you have the destiny of 180 million people in your hand.
Thank you.
Can do whatever you want to do with it.
Thank you. What about you, Alona? You have 47 counties.
Yes.
And we're talking about devolution here. And the last time I checked, we're talking about 15%, at least 15% that is given to counties.
Mm-hmm.
What does that do?
Other than
probably paying salaries for the county elite.
You know, we just had a devolution conference maybe a month ago.
Mm-hmm.
And most of the governors were speaking, and the issue that came up more was lack of funds. They're not getting enough. So when you bring the 15%, it's probably not enough. But like I said, the system is young, and I don't think they thought it through before they devolved whatever services were devolved to the county government. Let's say, for example, health. Health was devolved from the national government to the county. Health is a very expensive sector.
But we are talking about primary health here. Correct?
The whole health.
For the counties.
Yeah, for the counties. So the counties responsible for the health. It's been devolved to the county system. So health has been an issue even for the national government. We had nurses and doctors on the street pretty much every other month. So for them to have not gotten it right and then take it and devolve it down to the county government that was just starting, I think has created more of a problem. The devolution of services, in my opinion, should have been snowballed. You know, give them a little at a time. Let them get that right before you give them more. But when you bring health, education, trade, all that to a newborn system, you know, it became so overwhelmed that counties are disappropriately managing the health. You know, there are counties that have very, very good healthcare systems. They have their level 5, level whatever hospitals that are very equipped providing the services. Well, you have some counties that are doing dismal. So then the question becomes, why are others doing so well and others doing so bad? Is it the 15% that's too little, or is it somebody else is managing theirs better than the other? So it's the picture is, you know, just bigger than just looking at it from an outside look. We have to go right into the system and compare this. Because if the 15% is being distributed and everybody's getting pretty much equal to whatever they deserve, there's no reason why one county should do much better than the other. The second thing is that our county government is solely depending on national government funding. I think they should look at other avenues. They should look into grant funding. They should look into, you know, donor funding and other ways that they can better their, you know, their life for their people to make devolution actually work.
Now, talking about devolution, there are some cynics who actually say that what has probably been successful so far, in their words, not mine, is the devolution of corruption.
Amen. That's actually that's very true. And the problem is as the electorates, because when devolution was announced or when it was to kick in, you had all this. Cartels and older politicians who have been in the system for so long and didn't do much for us ran back to the counties and vie for these positions. And us being who we are, we elected them. Because our elections, even though the elections, like you had said, it's a lot more behind it. You have to be in the inside group to be elected. You have to have the money to distribute. So being that they were already out there, so we basically just devolved the problems they had in Nairobi, which is where the national government is, back to us. So this cancer of corruption is also still very much of a problem. And besides corruption, we've also devolved tribalism that was away there, you know, is back in the county, nepotism. And now even with the county being much closer to the village, we have clanism.
I see.
Which is also now a problem. You know, if he's not from my clan, he's not being elected. And then also under the devolution system of Kenya, we have a position called the MCAs. These are ward representatives who are supposed to oversight the governor.
I see. Well, time happens not to be our best ally, so I have to go because if the producer says you go, you have to go. You are tuned into Straight Talk Africa. We'll have more of a discussion in a moment, including our social media segment. So please, don't go away because we'll be right back with you.
Like Voice of America on Facebook. Follow VOA on Twitter. Join VOA on our YouTube channel. Like, follow, join VOA.
This is Straight Talk Africa on the Voice of America. Call us now with your questions and comments. The number is 202-619-3111 and the U.S. country code is 1. Call us direct and we'll call you right back. Remember to turn down the volume on your radio or television and keep your comments brief. Now back to Straight Talk Africa.
Thank you very much, Esther Gizuyuwat, and of course, welcome Straight Talk Africa, live from Washington. It's time to bring in our social media reporter, Heidi Adams-Fitzpatrick. Take it away, Heidi.
Thank you very much, Shaka. We've received excellent social media feedback this week. We are discussing the relationship between political inclusion and decentralized government systems to involve women in policy-making decisions and to take services closer to the people on the continent. This leads us to our question of the week, which asked, how do you feel about decentralized systems of government in Africa? Let's go to our first tweet from Manika Chella, who tweets, political inclusion and decentralization systems in Africa are good as far as smooth delivery of social services is concerned, but the blunders come when the ruling parties take them politically. We'll go now to our social media comment of the week from Facebook fan Chinonso Sammy from Nigeria, who writes, decentralization is good when the principles are also applied in government. But here in Africa, politicians have not come to terms with the tenets of leadership. Africa's leaders see political positions as a good avenue to drain the wealth of the people. Let's go to another Facebook comment from Kabasu Manhoti from Zambia, and he writes, decentralization is the way to go, except that here in Zambia, it's only on paper. And our last Facebook comment comes from Manulale Gira from Conarias from Uganda, who writes, in Africa, decentralization is on paper, but power and authority is cuffed in the central governments and to leaders in particular. A reminder, of course, that we appreciate all of your feedback. If you are a new fan, do drop us a line at africatv@voanews.com. You can also comment on our Facebook page. Just enter these keywords, Straight Talk Africa, and be sure to visit us online at voaafrica.com. You can also join our YouTube channel, sign up to VOA TV to Africa, and do follow us on Twitter at VOA Shaka. Straight Talk Africa also streams live every Wednesday on Facebook. You can simply go to VOA Straight Talk Africa TV program page that is on our website. Also, watch us live on your mobile device. Download the VOA mobile app. Now let's take a look at what is ahead for next week's program.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, the 31st African Union Summit is underway in Mauritania. Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari is slated to do a presentation on this year's summit theme, Winning the Fight Against Corruption, a Sustainable Path to Africa's Transformation. AU leaders are also expected to launch the Continental Free Trade Area. An in-depth discussion on the 2018 AU Summit on the next Straight Talk Africa.
And that is all for today's social media segment. Shaka, you and your guests, of course, have a lot of comments to discuss, so I'm going to hand it back to you.
Thanks, Heidi. And today, of course, we are discussing the relationship between political inclusion and decentralized government systems in Africa. Our guests are Dr. Lona Were, founder and director of the International Patient Learning Empowerment and Advocacy, Gilbert Mwenedata, former Rwandan presidential aspirant, and Banji Airoge, political scientist and activist, who also previously served in various capacities with Ondo State and the Nigerian federal government. He joins us from New York. Well, I have to say, ladies and gentlemen, once again, I'm profoundly honored and exceedingly humbled to have the opportunity to host the three of you for the first time on Straight Talk Africa.
Thank you.
You're most welcome. Let me come to you, Mwene Data. You know, Rwanda has, of course, a world record in terms of women empowerment, at least in terms of the coverage and what have you. But if true, then how come we don't hear those female voices complaining or promoting the interests, for example, of two important Rwandan women who are rotting in prison? We're talking about Victoire Ingabire. We're also talking about Diana Rwigara.
Actually,
so who do those women, in fact, represent?
Thank you for asking that, because even to me, when it comes to inclusion, I understand it in the way, like, of saying who to include. People may say women, youth, disabled people, and others, minority groups. But also, when you look to what to include, are their concerns included? Are their ideas included? Are their political views included, especially when they are different from what the government wants them to say? So now, as you say, those ladies we have in parliament, 64% of them, but also, yeah, on that point, as I said, it's good to do that because as a country, Rwanda, we have that record. But also on the other side, as you said, we have a big number of them in jail. Actually, the two of them, as you mentioned, Victoire Ingabire and Diane Rwigara, they have been presidential aspirants. Actually, they have not even been candidates because they were not allowed to. So,
like you.
Like me. So that means only the intention of trying to run for office, of trying to run for presidency, it becomes a crime.
But why should that be a crime when we are told that the Rwandan president, Major General Paul Kagame, retired but certainly not tired, is an incredibly popular individual, an incredibly beloved leader, to the extent that he almost got 100% in the last time when you are having a referendum and the election? What does he fear?
Actually, me too, I can't even pretend to understand everything about it, but what I know is, like, they are in jail. Even me, if I was in Rwanda, I was to be in jail. And also, if I can first of all, like, share my impressions, even when I am interacting with people, even let's say when a friend of mine or is hosting me at the house, and some people from my country, when he has information that they may come, we are here in America, they are afraid, like, if they are known to be hosting me somewhere in America, that something bad may happen to them. So it's like, even though you did nothing wrong, but it's like, even people now, what they think is like the simple fact of hosting you, the simple fact of communicating with you, that's something that can cost their lives. So that's why, as you say, how does it become a crime? Even me, I don't understand. But for now, it's a fact, because we've seen a number of people now being in jail despite, you know, them being something that is completely legal. So even to me, I don't know. I don't know why it can really become illegal. And as you said, for the two women who are in jail only for being presidential aspirants, and the other majority of women who are in parliament, they cannot raise their voice because the one who put them there in the parliament is doing the way they, you know, is doing the things the way he wants. and they know why they are there, and they know what they can say and lose their seat in parliament. So that's why they keep quiet.
When you say the one who put them in parliament, what precisely do you... Who are you talking about here?
Okay, here is the point. It's in parliament, as you've said, like in Rwanda, when you see what we went through, like those constitutional amendments and everything else we've been going through. So when you look to that, you will realize like all those things have been passing in the parliament. It was close also to 100%. It's like the way it is done, and you ask who put them there. In many cases, they go there because the ruling party wants them to be there, and because for anything they want it to pass. Actually, that's why I was saying it doesn't matter to me who is there, but it's about what they are doing. So that's why when the concerns of those groups are not, like they don't care of their concerns, for example, the women, they don't even take care of their own concerns. That's why that high number of women, they can go there and reduce the maternity leave. You know, it's like they say, and you say, why do they do that? They are women. They know what it means to have a baby. And don't they think after having a baby, they need like some time for leave? So, and also, and even other things like, you know, having guns. For a country like Rwanda, where we had a genocide, all those are the laws that can pass through the parliament. Like, and when you look at them, you say, sometimes maybe you may have a number of people, but when it comes to the quality of what they are passing through the parliament, in many cases, it does reflect how they get there, not the citizens putting them there, but the few who are in power. They put there whoever they think will be representing only their needs. That's why 99% is not a surprise to us.
Very interesting. Mr. Bangi.
Yes.
Are you there?
I'm here.
You know,
it looks like I'm in the way down, I see.
You know, I was reading a book called African President's Daughter. Okay. It is written by Dr. Iyabo Obasanjo.
Okay.
The first daughter of former Nigerian president, General Olusegun Obasanjo, retired but certainly not tired.
Right.
She worked as a commissioner in this Ogun State.
In Ogun State, yes.
She lived in Abeokuta, where, of course, her family comes from.
Right.
And she eventually became a senator.
Yes.
In Abuja. But she talks about her experiences when she was a commissioner of health in Ogun State. She refers to the governor at that time as the emperor.
Right.
And that almost everybody, frankly, who worked around him or with him could not deceive themselves or pretend that they had the right to own an opinion, so long as that opinion was different from the emperor.
Right.
To what extent has this devolution really helped to bring services closer to the people, again, rather than perhaps to develop corruption, dictatorship, unemployment again really for the elite, for example, in the context of Nigeria, of the state?
Right. Well, I also, like Iyabo, I also work for a governor in Ondo State, and I didn't have the same experience. Actually, I have a very different experience from what she had. Oh, perhaps we can say that things were still better at the time I served, because I served, you know, many years before her. However, let me say this. You see, when the head is rotten, definitely the body and the feet are going to be rotten. It's like a fish. Well, what we have in Nigeria is our rotten system at the federal level. The federal level, whatever is being done wrongly at the federal level, seems to come straight down to all the levels. When you had the head of the federal government busy with you know, all these corrupt tendencies and all these dictatorial tendencies, then you have the governors doing the same thing and the head of the local government doing the same thing. Devolution of power is supposed to be this. And I will go back and I will tell a story what an elder statesman, Anthony Enahoro, said when he was alive. He told us, you know, because we were in the pro-democracy movement together, and he told us that the reason corruption is so strive in Nigeria is that whenever you people go to the federal government in the center, people view you as going for their own share of the nation's resources. You have captured, they have co-opted you to bring back home their own share of the national cake. Whereas if you devolve power to the locals, whatever money is voted for road, for instance, let's pick up road. If somebody says road should be constructed, I mean, if the assembly says road should be constructed, you know, from point A to your area of the town, and several million naira or dollars, let's say, has been earmarked for that project, and you fail to do it, or you do a shoddy work, Chief Enahoro says, people in that community will come to you. They will go to your parents. They will go to your wife. They will go to your children and look, we heard that X amount of money was voted for. Where is that money? Or why is the road not constructed? But when you are dealing with some amorphous institution in Abuja or at the central government, it is hard for people to, first of all, relate that to their own plight in their locality. Number two, you don't have anybody to hold responsible, in which case, a more responsible, a system that can be much more responsive and where accountability will be much more pronounced is the in the local level. But what we have, we hear of several billions being voted for certain projects, and at the end of it all, we don't see anything. There is nobody to be held accountable. And the people just wring their hand and say, what can we do? That is why devolution of power is the end thing, is what Nigerians are pressing for. Corruption that the president is making a whole, you know, noise about. There is no greater corruption than what is happening now without devolution of power. Because you have all these institutions, you know, we hear that several trillions of dollars or nairas have been voted, but there is no corresponding, you know, projects at the end of it all to say that, you know, this money was spent. But I can assure you, if you send $2 billion or naira to my local government, which is the third tier of government in Nigeria, and the budget says road will be constructed across my town to the neighboring villages, if it is not done at the end of that financial year, I will be asking questions from the local chairman, I mean, the council chairman and the councillors and everybody. That is the reason that devolution of power to the states and the locality is a must in Africa, if we are going to go. Like I said, people are getting fed up, seeing their resources going into private hands, some using it and buying homes in London and in New York. They are tired of that. And that is why, and on the security level, like I said before, on the security level, it is not just on corruption alone. When people talk about corruption, corruption is the least of the worries, you know, among Nigerians right now. The threat to life and property is the greatest. This is the reason. When the federal government mops up all this money, it's supposed to provide police. How can 200 million Nigerians rely on the capital of Nigeria to protect each and every villages? It's not possible. Logistically, it's not even possible. The system that people are asking for is a system that allows my local government to have its own police, the states to have their own police. The federal government can actually have its own police if they want to. The system is very clear that no one government can actually take care of all the security problems of the country. What we now have is a situation where somebody in the center can decide to not even protect those of you in all the other regions. And it's becoming dangerous because at the present time, the president of Nigeria is a Fulani man. And the Fulanis are having their own incursion into the central region of Nigeria, killing and macheting everybody. And so Nigerians are now looking at the federal government, that the reason the federal government is not even talking about these killings is because the man who is the president of Nigeria is a Fulani man. This is a very dangerous precedent. We know that the issue of tribes in that region is not new. But for the first time, the president is being complacent in tackling it. He doesn't even talk about it. How can 200 people be macheted on a Sunday, including priests from the church? And what the government did was to send the vice president to go there. It's never heard.
I see.
It's never heard of. And because of this, devolution of power in Africa is the only way we can prevent, yes, we can prevent civil strife.
Thank you.
And war.
Thank you. Let's go to the lifeline of the show, which are the telephone callers. Good evening, Patrick, from the Republic of Nigeria.
Good evening, our guest.
Patrick, are you there?
Yes, I'm there.
What is your question or your observation?
Okay, my observation is that, Mr. Shaka, the major problem we have today is that there are a lot of power in the federal level. That is why you see states normally run to the federal government to collect allocation. That's a problem. And I want to find out from this, why is it that today in Africa, the leaders don't like to use office? They would like to change the group. Thank you very much.
The leaders don't like to do what?
To leave power
or something?
I thought I said leave power.
Maybe something of that sort. I didn't quite really understand what the question was. Now, Lona, what do you think needs to be done really and must be done in order to make sure that the ordinary Kenyan, for example, or ordinary African citizen gets the services that they deserve? Because when you look at your country, for example, there are reports suggesting that right from independence, and we're talking about, was it in December 12, 1963?
Yeah.
That the country actually may have started on the wrong foot. That it first and foremost succeeded at institutionalizing corruption and what they call tribalism. Yeah, you agree with those who say that?
Yeah, that's very true. We haven't grown much since independence as a people and also just as a country. To begin with, you have to realize that infrastructure has to grow with the population. If you have a hospital, you have to keep building on it as people increase. But that's not happening in our countries, basically in most African countries. So one thing is that our government need to realize that we need to expand our infrastructure to match our population that is expanding. The second thing that will probably really help us is civic education of the electorates. We have to understand our rights. We have to know how to ask for them. That's not there in Africa. Africa is a country where someone goes to seek medical help and they think it's a favor.
Correct.
So they don't demand what's right. They don't demand quality. We need to educate our people to understand, you know, what to ask for, to know that there is better than what you're being offered. That way, then, we will be able to hold our leaders accountable, because corruption is rampant because nobody's holding them accountable. If the national government cannot question them, then we as a people need to put pressure on them. For example, devolution is working. We are getting projects done at the county levels. But you get they bring you a road that technically should cost $5 million, but they tell you we're going to construct it at $60 million. As a citizen, you should say, no, that's costing me too much, because that's our money that they're using. It's your taxpayers' money. So we should not just accept these services because we need them at such a big expense to us.
But how do you make those authorities accountable to you?
Basically, in Kenya with the devolution system, we have what is called the community participation, whereby before a project is launched, you have to meet the community. First of all, when the budget is drawn out, there are usually community call-outs where they inform you of what's coming up. Then once they award the tenders, the person who is going to implement the tender is supposed to meet with the community as well. This is the time that you should bring up those pertinent questions. How much is this costing us? You know, could we have done it any different? And, you know issues like that. But what happens is when these meetings are called, we as a people don't go because we don't understand the value of this. So going back to the civic education, we need to be educated to understand these forums are important. You can ask for this. You can, you know, it can help you in this way. You know, those will also help us. Second of all, the guy, Mr. Banji, said that most of the devolution in Africa is on paper. And I agree with that. We have beautiful policies that are just sitting. You know, we have constitutions that are just sitting somewhere. They're not being implemented. If implemented, it's done to favor whoever is implementing it or in a way that's easier for them.
Well, time is not, of course, our best ally. Is it possible to do those types of things without a democracy, really? Because I gather that the priority of the Rwandan government, for example, is providing service delivery.
That
you should not worry about democracy because you can't eat it.
That's right.
Is service delivery and democracy mutually exclusive, or are they mutually reinforcing, really?
To me, actually, I understand that they are mutually reinforcing. But to me, when you look at the way even decentralization has been understood, you can see, like, as you say, a mismatch between, democracy and economic growth. Because some think, you know, that you cannot have both. Then you can just go for economic growth or you get the services. But when it comes to democracy, they say, you know, we still need to grow. We need some time. It's a young democracy, you know, all those excuses to be there so that they may continue to delay and delay. So, and when you look at that, to me, normally, even this, all this thing of decentralization can be understand like what it is for the government. It should be understood like what the cells are for the body.
Unfortunately, time happens not to be our best ally. On that note, today's guests were Dr. Lona Were, Gilbert Mwenedata, and Banji Ayiloge, who joined us from New York. Thanks to our field stations, along with our viewers and listeners. For many of our Voice of America radio affiliates, Learning English is coming up next. And tomorrow morning's Daybreak Africa with James Bate. On behalf of the Voice of America, thanks for tuning into Straight Talk Africa. In the meantime, get better, not beta, Africa. And please remember to keep the African hopes alive.